With him? Only high-ranking officials know the future, she said, and smiled. The dear leader nodded in appreciation. See, that's what I've missed. That's right there. Sun Moon took a first sip of her drink. So who is this new pupil? She asked. Does she appreciate your subtleties, your humor? The dear leader leaned forward some, happy to have her engage him again. She is no you, I can tell you that. She has none of your beauty, your charm, your way with words. Sun Moon feigned, being startled. She has no way with words? You tease me now, he said. You know she speaks only English. She is no Sun Moon, I grant you that. But don't underestimate her, this American girl. Don't think my rower girl doesn't have her own special qualities, her own dark energy. Now Sun Moon leaned forward so that over the bar the two were close. Answer me this, my dearest leader, she said, and please speak from the heart. Can a spoiled American girl handle the grand notions that emanate from a mind as great as yours? Can this girl from a land of corruption and greed comprehend the purity of your wisdom? Is she worthy of you, or should she be sent home so that a real woman can take her place? The dear leader reached behind the bar. He produced for Sun Moon a bar of soap, a comb, and a Chosun ot that seemed cut from pure gold. That's what you're going to tell me, he said. Citizens, observe the hospitality our dear leader shows for all peoples of the world, even a subject of the despotic United States. Does the dear leader not dispatch our nation's best woman to give solace and support to this wayward American? And does Sun Moon not find the girl rower housed in a beautiful room, fresh and white and brightly lit with a pretty little window affording a view of a lovely North Korean meadow and the dappled horses that frolic there? This is not dingy China or soiled little South Korea. So do not picture some sort of a prison cell with lamp-blacked walls and rust-colored puddles on the floor. Instead, notice the large white tub fitted with golden lion's feet and filled with the steaming, restorative water of the Taedong. Sun Moon approached her. Though the rower was young, her skin had been marred by the sun and the sea. Still, her spirit seemed strong. Perhaps her year as a guest of our great nation had given her life focus and conviction. Undoubtedly, it had provided this American the only chastity she had ever known. Sun Moon helped her disrobe, holding the rower's garments as she removed them. The girl's shoulders were broad, and strong cords were visible in her neck. There was a small circular scar on the rower's upper arm. When Sun Moon touched this, words came from the rower that Sun Moon couldn't understand. And yet, a look crossed the girl rower's face that reassured Sun Moon that the mark was a sign of something good, if such a wound was possible. In the water, the American reclined, and Sun Moon sat at the head of the tub, wetting the rower's dark, straight hair one ladle at a time. The last inch of her hair was distressed and needed to come off. But Sun Moon had no scissors. Instead, Sun Moon massaged the soap into her scalp, raising a lather. So, you are the woman of endurance, of aloneness, the survivor, Sun Moon said as she rinsed and soaped and rinsed again. The girl that has captured the attention of all the males. You're a female who struggles, yes? A student of solitude? You must think we know nothing of adversity in our happy little nation of plenty. Perhaps you think I am a doll on a shelf in a hall of Yangbans, that my life will be a diet of shrimp and peaches until I retire to the beaches of Wonsan. Sun Moon moved to the foot of the tub, where she began washing the rower's long toes and ungainly feet. My grandmother was a great beauty, Sun Moon said. During the occupation, she was singled out to become the comfort woman for Emperor Taisho, the decadent predecessor to Hirohito. The dictator was short and sickly, with thick glasses. She was kept in a fortress by the sea, which the emperor visited at the end of each week. He would ravage her at the bay window, where with binoculars he could also keep track of his fleet. Such was his need to control her that the evil little man insisted that she act happy. Sun Moon soaped the rower's taut ankles and withered calves. When my grandmother attempted to leap from the window, the emperor tried to cheer her up with a paddle boat shaped like a swan. Then he bought her a mechanical horse that circled a pole on a metal track. When she tried to throw herself on the ocean's jagged reef, a shark rose. "Endure," the shark said. "I must dive each day to the bottom of the sea for my dinner. Surely you can find a way to survive." When she placed her neck in the gears of the mechanical horse, a finch landed and implored her to keep living. "I must fly around the world to find my little seeds. Certainly you can last another day." In her room, as she waited for the arrival of the emperor, she stared at the wall. Gazing at the mortar binding the wall stones, she thought, "I can hold fast a little longer." The dear leader turned her story into a screenplay for me, so I know what my grandmother felt. I have tasted her words and stood waiting by her side for the Japanese dictator's inevitable arrival. Sun Moon motioned for the rower to stand, and she washed the girl's entire body like a giant child, skin glistening above the gray-stained water in which she stood. And the choices my own mother had to make are things about which I can't even speak. If I am alone in this world, stripped of my siblings, it is because of the decisions she had to make. There were freckles along the girl rower's arms and down her back. Sun Moon had never seen freckles before. Even just a month before, she would have viewed them as flaws marring otherwise even skin. But now the freckles suggested there were other kinds of beauty in the world than simply striving to be made from Pyongyang porcelain. "Perhaps adversity has skipped my generation," Sun Moon told her. "Maybe it's true that I don't know real suffering, that I haven't stuck my head in mechanical gears or rode around the world in the dark. Maybe I am untouched by loneliness and sorrow." They were silent as Sun Moon helped the rower step from the tub, and they did not speak as she toweled the American's body. The Chosun Ot, utterly golden, was exquisite. Sun Moon pinched the fabric here and there until the dress fell perfectly. Finally, Sun Moon began weaving the rower's hair into a single braid. "I do know that my turn as suffering will come," she said. "Everyone's does. Mine might be just around the corner. I wonder of what you must daily endure in America, having no government to protect you, no one to tell you what to do. Is it true you're given no ration card, that you must find food for yourself? Is it true that you labor for no higher purpose than paper money? What is California, this place you come from? I have never seen a picture. What plays over the American loudspeakers? When is your curfew? What is taught at your child-rearing collectives? Where does a woman go with her children on Sunday afternoons? And if a woman loses her husband, how does she know the government will assign her a good replacement? With whom will she curry favor to ensure her children got the best youth troop leader?" Here Sun Moon realized she had gripped the girl rower's wrists, and her questions had become demands leveled into the rower's wide eyes. "How does a society without a fatherly leader work?" someone implored. "How can a citizen know what is best without a benevolent hand to shepherd her? Isn't that endurance? Learning how to navigate such a realm alone? Isn't that survival?" The girl rower took her hands back and gestured toward some unknown distance. Sun Moon had a feeling this woman was asking about the end of the story, of what became of the Emperor's comfort woman, his private Kiseng. "She waited until she was older, my grandmother," Sun Moon said. "She waited until she was back in her village, and all her children had been grown and married away. And that's when she unsheathed her long-hidden knife and took her honor back." Whatever was going through the girl rower's mind, the strength of Sun Moon's words moved her to act. The rower, too, began speaking with some force, trying to get Sun Moon to understand something vital. The American went to a small table with a lamp and many notebooks. She brought to Sun Moon one of the inspirational works of Kim Jong-il, in a clear attempt to help guide Sun Moon to the only wisdom that had a chance of alleviating the actress's woes. The rower shook the book and then began speaking fast, a rapid gibberish that was impossible for Sun Moon to make out. "Citizens, what was this poor American rower saying? We didn't need a translator to understand she was despondent at the prospect of leaving North Korea, which had become a second home to her. No one needed an English dictionary to feel her anguish at the idea of being torn from a paradise where food and shelter and medical care were free. Citizens, feel her sadness at having to return to a land where doctors chase pregnant women with ultrasounds. Sense her outrage at being sent back to a crime-laden land of materialism and exclusion, where huge populations languish in jail, sprawl urine-soaked in the streets, or babble incoherently about God on the sweatpants-polished pews of megachurches. Think of the guilt she must feel after learning how the Americans, her own people, devastated this great nation during the imperialist sneak attack war. But despair no more, rower girl. Even this small taste of North Korean compassion and generosity might see you through the dark days of your return to Uncle Sam's savagery."
I was tired when I arrived at Division 42. I hadn't slept well the night before. My dreams were filled with dark snakes, whose hissing sounded like the peasants I had heard during intercourse. But why snakes? Why would snakes haunt me so, with their accusing eyes and folded fangs? None of the subjects I put in the autopilot ever visited me in my sleep. In the dream, I had Commander Gaw's cell phone, and on it kept flashing pictures of a smiling wife and happy children. Only it was my wife and my children, the family I have always felt I should have had. All I had to do was discover their location and make my way through the snakes to them. But what did the dream mean? That's what I couldn't fathom. If only a book could be written to help the average citizen penetrate and understand a dream's mysteries. Officially, the government took no position on what occurred while its citizens were asleep. But isn't something of the dreamer to be found in his dream? And what of the extended open-eye dream I afforded our subjects when I hooked them up to the autopilot? I have sat for hours watching our subjects in this state. The oceany eye sweep, the babyish talk, the groping, the way they were always reaching for something, seen with a faraway focus. And then there are the orgasms, which the doctors insist are actually seizures. Either way, something profound takes place inside these people. In the end, all they can remember is the icy mountain peak and the white flower to be found there. Is a destination worth reaching if you can't recall the journey? I'd say so. Is a new life worth living if you can't recollect the old one? All the better. At work, I discovered a couple of guys from propaganda sniffing around our library, looking for a good story. one they could use to inspire the people, they said. I wasn't about to let them near our biographies again. We don't have any good stories, I told them. Man, they were slick, with their gold-rimmed teeth and Chinese cologne. Any story would do, one said. Good or bad, it doesn't matter. Yeah, his sidekick added. We'll add the inspiration later. Last year, they swiped the biography of a lady missionary who had snuck in from the south with a satchel full of Bibles. We were told to find out who she had given Bibles to and if more like her walked amongst us. She was the one person the pubic couldn't crack, except for Commander Gaw, I suppose. Even when I hooked her up to the autopilot, she had the strangest smile on her face. She had a thick set of spectacles that magnified her eyes as they pleasantly roamed the room. Even when the autopilot was in its peak cycle, she hummed a Jesus song and beheld the last room she had ever seen as if it were filled with goodness. As if in the eyes of Jesus, all places were created equal, and with her own eyes, she saw that this was so and thought it good. When the propaganda boys got done with her story, though, she was a monstrous capitalist spy bent on kidnapping loyal children of the party to work as slaves in a Bible factory in Seoul. My parents were addicted to the story. Every night I had to listen to their summary of the loudspeaker's latest installment. Go write your own tales of North Korean triumph, I told the boys from propaganda. But we require real stories, one told me. Don't forget, the other added, these stories are not yours. They're the property of the people. How would you like me to take your biographies? I asked them, and didn't miss the implied threat. They said, we'll be back. I stuck my head in the pubic lounge, which was empty. The place was littered with empty bottles, which meant they had pulled an all-nighter. On the floor was a pile of long black hair. I knelt down and lifted a lock, silken in the light. Oh, Kyuki, I thought, inhaling slowly and deeply. I smelled her essence. Looking up to the big board, I saw that the pubic had cleared my cases, every one of them, except for Commander Gaw. All those people, all their stories, lost. That's when I noticed Kyuki in the doorway watching me. Her head was indeed buzzed, and she wore a pubic brown shirt, military pants, and Commander Gaw's black boots. I dropped the swirl of hair and rose from my knees. Kyuki, I said, good to see you. She said nothing. I see a lot has changed since I was conscripted to help with the harvest. I'm sure it was voluntary, she said. Of course it was. Pointing at the pile of hair, I added, I was just using my investigative skills. To determine what? There was an awkward silence. It looks like you've got the commander's boots there, I said. They should fetch a good barter at the night market. Actually, they fit me pretty well, she said. I think I'll keep them. I nodded, admired her boots a moment. Then I caught her eye. Are you still my intern? I asked. You didn't switch sides, did you? She reached out to me. There was a folded slip of paper in her fingers. I'm handing you this, aren't I? She said. I opened the paper. It was some kind of hand-drawn map. There were sketches of a corral, a fire pit, fishing poles, and guns. Some of the words were in English, but I could make out the word Texas. Kyuki said, I found this inside Gaw's right boot. What do you think it is? I asked her. It might be the place where we find our actress. Kyuki turned to go. but then she looked back. You know, I've seen all her movies. The Pyubyok. They don't seem to care about really finding her. And they couldn't get Ga, or whoever he is, to talk. But you'll get results, right? You'll find Sun Moon. She needs a proper burial. Results. That's the side I'm on. I studied the map a long time. I had it spread across the Pyubyok ping pong table and was contemplating every word and line when Sarge came in. He was soaking wet. "Been doing some waterboarding?" I asked him.
"Actually, it's raining," he said. "A big storm's coming in from the Yellow Sea."
Sarge rubbed his palms together. Though he smiled, I could tell his hands were hurting. I pointed at the big board. "I see there was a mass confession while I was out." Sarge shrugged.
"We got a whole team of Pyubyok with time on their hands. And here you were with 10 open cases, just you and 2 interns. We're only showing some solidarity."
"Solidarity?" I asked. "What happened to Leonardo?"
"Who?"
"My team leader, the baby-faced one. He left work one night and never came back. Like the rest of the guys who used to be on my team."
"You're asking me to solve one of life's mysteries," he said. "Who's to say what becomes of people? Why does rain fall down and not up? Why was the snake created cowardly while the dog was born vicious?"
I couldn't tell if he was mocking me or not. Sarge wasn't exactly a philosopher. And since Leonardo's disappearance, Sarge had acted strangely civil toward me. I returned to the crudely penciled sketch of the Texas village. He stood there, massaging his hands.
"My joints," he said. "They're a murder when it rains."
I ignored him. Sarge looked over my shoulder.
"What do you have there? Some kind of map?"
"Some kind." He looked closer.
"Oh yeah," he said. "The old military base west of town."
"What makes you say that?" He pointed.
"There's the road to Nampo. And look, here's the fork in the Taedong."
He turned to me.
"This have to do with Commander Ga?"
Finally, the kind of lead we've been looking for, the chance to crack this case wide open. I folded the map.
"I've got work to do," I said.
Sarge stopped me from leaving.
"You know," he said, "you don't have to write an entire book about every citizen that comes through the door."
But I did have to. Was anyone else going to tell a citizen's story? Was there going to be any other proof that someone ever existed? If I took the time to learn everything about them, if I made a record, then I was okay with the kinds of things that happened to them afterward. The autopilot, the prison mines, the soccer stadium at dawn. If I wasn't a biographer, then who was I? What did I really do for a living?
"Am I getting through to you?" Sarge asked.
"Nobody even reads those books. They gather dust in a dark room. So quit killing yourself. Try it our way for once. Knock out a few quick confessions, and then come have a beer with the guys. We'll let you load the karaoke machine."
"What about Commander Ga?" I asked.
"What about him?"
"His biography is the most important one." Sarge stared at me with cosmic frustration.
"First of all," he said, "that's not Commander Ga. Did you forget that? Second, he wouldn't talk. He's had pain training. The halo didn't even touch him. Most important, there's no mystery to solve."
"Of course there is," I said. "Who is he? What happened to the actress? Where's her body, her kids?"
"You think the guy's at the top?"
Sarge said, pointing down to the bunker below.
"You think they don't know the real story? They know where the Americans were hosted. They were there. You think the dear leader doesn't know what happened? I bet Sun Moon was probably standing to his right while Commander Ga was to his left."
Then what was our purpose, I wondered? What was it we were interrogating and why? If they have all the answers, I said, what are they waiting for? How long can the people wonder why our national actress has gone missing? And what about our national hero, the holder of the Golden Belt? How long can the dear leader not acknowledge they have mysteriously vanished?
Don't you think the dear leader has his reasons?
Sarge asked me.
And just so you know, you don't get to tell people stories. The state does. If a citizen does something worthy of a story, good or bad, then it's up to the dear leader's people. They're the only ones who get to tell a story.
I don't tell people stories. My job is to listen and write down what I hear. And if you're talking about the boys from propaganda, everything they say is a lie. Sarge stared at me in wonderment, as if only now did he realize the size of the gulf between us.
Your job, he started to say.
Then he started to say something else. He kept shaking his hands, trying to expel the pain. Finally, he turned to leave, pausing only a moment in the doorway.
I did my training at that base, he said. You don't want to be anywhere near Nampo during a storm.
When he was gone, I called the central motor pool and told them we would need a vehicle to take us toward Nampo. Then I gathered Kyuki and Jujak. Round up some rain slickers and shovels, I told them. We're going to fetch an actress. It turned out the only vehicle that could get us down the road to Nampo in the rain was an old Soviet Zeer. When it pulled up, the driver was none too happy, since someone had stolen his windshield wipers. Jujak shook his head at the sight and backed away.
No way, he said. My father told me never to get in a crow.
Kyuki had a shovel in her hand.
Shut up and get in the truck, she told him.
Soon the three of us were headed west into the storm. The dark canopy was made of oiled canvas, which kept the rain out, though sprays of muddy water rose through the slats in the bed. The bench seats we sat on had been carved with people's names. It was probably the work of folks being transported to faraway prison mines like 22 or 1418, voyages that would give a person lots of time to think. Such was the human urge to be remembered. Kyuki ran her fingers over the carvings, tracing one name in particular.
I knew a Yong Yap Nam, she said. He was in my Evils of Capitalism class.
It's probably a different Yong Yap Nam, I reassured her. She shrugged. If a citizen goes bad, he goes bad. What else should he expect?
Jujak wouldn't look at any of the names. Why don't we wait till after the storm? He kept saying. What's the point of going out there now? We probably won't find anything. There's probably nothing to find.
The wind started to rattle the black canopy, its metal ribs groaning. A cascade of water poured from the road, sluicing over the sewage ditches. Kyuki leaned her head on her shovel handle, staring out the back of the truck at the two channels our tires cut through the water. Kyuki asked me, You don't think Sun Moon could have gone bad, do you?
I shook my head. No way.
I want to find Sun Moon as much as anybody, she said. But then she'll be dead. It's like until our shovels unearth her, she still seems alive. It's true that when I'd been imagining finding Sun Moon, I'd been picturing the radiant woman on all the movie posters. It was only now that I visualized my shovel raising up pieces of decomposed children, of the shovel's blade sinking into the abdomen of a corpse.
When I was a girl, my father took me to see Glory of Glories. I've been acting out a lot, and my father wanted me to see what happened to women who challenged authority.
Jujak said,
That the movie where Sun Moon gets her head cut off?
It's about more than that, Kyuki said.
Good special effects, though, Jujak added. The way Sun Moon's head rolls away, and everywhere the blood spills, the flowers of martyrdom spring from the ground and blossom. That had me, man. I was there.
Of course everyone knew the movie. Sun Moon plays a poor girl who confronts the Japanese officer who controls her farming village. The peasants must relinquish their harvest to the Japanese, but some rice goes missing, and the officer decrees that all will starve until the culprit is caught. Sun Moon stands up to the officer and tells him it is his own corrupt soldiers who have stolen the rice. For this affront, the officer has her beheaded in the town square. Never mind what the movie was really about, or what my father thought it was about, Kyuki said. All around Sun Moon were powerful men. Yet she was without fear. I registered that. I saw the strength with which she accepted her fate. I saw how she changed the terms of men into her own. That I'm here right now in Division 42, I owe to her.
Oh, when she kneels down to take the sword,
Jujak said, as if he could see the moment before him.
Her back arches, her heavy chest swings forward, then her perfect lips part, and her eyelids slowly, slowly close.
The movie is filled with famous scenes, as when the old women in the village stay up all night, sewing the beautiful chosonote that Sun Moon will wear to her death. Or how before dawn, when Sun Moon is gripped by fear and falters in her resolve, a sparrow flies to her. The bird holds Kim Il-sung-jia blossoms in its beak to remind her that she does not sacrifice alone. The moment I remember, the point of the story at which no citizen could hold back tears, is when in the morning her parents bid her a final farewell. They say to her what has always gone unspoken, how she is the thing that gives meaning to their lives, that without her they will be lessened, that their love is of no use if not for her. I looked to Kyuki, deep in contemplation, and I wished for a moment that we weren't about to discover the decomposed remains of her hero. The crow left the road and drove into a basin, a field of shallow water as far as one could see. When I questioned the driver, he pointed to the map I'd given him. "This is it," he said. We looked out the back of the crow. The sky flashed white. Jujak said,
"We'll get diphtheria in all this runoff. Look, I bet there's nothing out there. This is probably a wild goose chase."
"We won't know until the shovel hits the mud," I told him.
"But we're probably just wasting our time,"
Jujak said.
"I mean, what if they moved it at the last minute?"
"What are you talking about, moved it?" Kyuki asked him. "Do you know something you're not telling us?"
Jujak looked warily at the darkening sky. Kyuki pressed him.
"You do know something, don't you?"
"Enough," I told him. "We only have a couple of hours of light." Then the three of us jumped from the crow into ankle-deep water that was sheened with oil and sewage foam. Everywhere around us was muddy water, as far as you could see. The map, long since soaked, pointed us toward a stand of trees. Using our shovels as probes, we made our way. Passing between us were the humps of river eels wrestling through the shallow water. The beasts were like biceps with teeth, some 2 meters long. The trees, it turned out, were filled with snakes. Their heads hung down to watch us splash from tree trunk to tree trunk. It was straight out of my awful dreams, as though the snakes from my sleep were visiting me here. Or did it work the other way? Would these snakes visit me again tonight? How I hoped not. Endure what one must during the day. But please, can I not have some peace when darkness falls?
"Those are rock mamushi," Kyuki said.
"Can't be," Jujak said. "Those only live in the mountains."
Kyuki turned to him.
"I know my deadly snakes," she said.
When distant lightning flashed, you could see them all, silhouetted in the branches, hissing, poised to drop on unsuspecting citizens as they went about their civic duties.
A snake is a fucking snake, I said. Just don't provoke them.
We looked around, but there was no sign of a fire pit or a corral. There was no chuck wagon, no guns or fishing poles, no stack of scythes.
We're in the wrong place, Zhuzhak said. We should get out of here before we get electrocuted.
No, Kyuki said. We dig.
Where?
Zhuzhak asked.
Everywhere, Kyuki said.
Zhuzhak stomped the blade of his shovel into the mud. With great effort, he pulled a single scoop of mud, sucking from a hole that filled with water. When he turned the shovel upside down, the mud stuck. Rain battered my face. I kept spinning the map, trying to see if I'd made a mistake. This should have been the place, the trees, the river, the road. What we needed was one of the dogs from the Central Zoo. It said their savage instincts can detect bones, even ones long under the earth.
This is impossible, Zhuzhak said. It's all just water. Where's the crime scene? Where's any scene?
That might work to our advantage, I told them. If a body were in the mud, the water might help float it free. All we need to do is go around loosening the soil.
So we went our ways, individually probing the mud for any sign of an actress below. I started turning shovels of mud, one after the other. Each time I did, I could visualize success. Each time I felt discovery was at hand and I would be able to leverage the actress to get Commander Gaw's story. And then his biography would be mine, with Gaw's real name in gold on the spine. And then Sarge's office would become mine. As the rain fell and fell, I kept coming up with pithy lines I would say as Sarge placed his meager possessions in an old food aid box and removed them from my new office. Finally, I felt, here was an event in my life worthy of inclusion in my own biography. The crow's drivers watched us from behind their windshield. It grew dark enough to see the red glow of their cigarettes. As my arms weakened, I switched from my right hand to my left. Every bone I struck turned out to be a tree root. If only a piece of silk would float up, or a shoe, perhaps. The eels kept striking at things in the muddy water, and thinking they were onto something, I began digging wherever they slashed their teeth and battled over unseen prey. Every clump of mud brought my spirits lower, and soon the day seemed less like the life I wanted, and more like the one I had. Slogging for nothing, the failures mounting. It was like my whole university experience. When I first arrived, I wondered which of these thousands of women was for me. Yet one by one, over time, I realized the answer was none. No, today certainly wasn't a chapter to include in my biography. In the dark, the only thing I could hear was Kyuki grunting each time she brought her weight to bear on the shovel. Finally, I shouted into the darkness.
Let's pack it in!
When Kyuki and I made it back to the crow, we discovered Zhuzhak already inside. We were soaked and shivering, our hands blistered from working wet handles. The soles of our feet sore from spading the heads of shovels 1,000 times into the mud. Kyuki stared at Zhuzhak the entire drive back to Division 42.
You knew she wasn't there, didn't you?
Kyuki kept saying to him.
You knew something, and you didn't tell us.
Right away, when we descended the stairs to Division 42, Kyuki marched up to Sarge.
Zhuzhak's holding out on us, she said. He knows something about this Commander God case. He's not telling us.
A grave look crossed Sarge's face. He studied Kyuki. Then he studied Zhuzhak.
That's a big accusation,
Sarge said to her.
You have any proof?
Kyuki pointed to her heart.
I can feel it, she said.
Sarge considered this, then nodded.
Okay,
he said.
Let's get the truth out of him.
A couple of pyubyok moved to grab Jujak.
Whoa,
I said, stepping in. Let's slow down.
A feeling isn't proof.
I put my hand on Jujak's shoulder.
Tell the truth, son, I said.
Just say what you know and I'll stand by you.
Jujak looked at our feet.
I don't know anything, I swear.
We all turned to Kyuki.
Don't take my word for it, she said. Look in his eyes. It's right there for everyone to see.
Sarge bent and looked in the boy's eyes. For the longest time, Sarge just stared. Then he nodded and said,
Take him away.
A couple of pyubyok put their hands on Jujak. A look of terror filled his eyes.
Wait,
I told them. But there was no stopping the floating wall. Soon Jujak was kicking as they dragged him toward the shop. Jujak screamed,
I'm the son of a minister!
Save it for your biography,
Sarge called after him, laughing.
I said, there's got to be some kind of mistake.
Sarge seemed not to hear me.
Fucking disloyalty, he said, shaking his head.
Then he turned to Kyuki.
Good work,
he said to her.
Get your smock on. You'll be the one to get the truth out of him.
Jujak was concealing something, and the only other person who knew what that might be was Commander Ga. I raced to the tank where we were holding him. Inside, Ga was shirtless, staring at his chest's reflection in the stainless steel wall. Without looking at me, Ga said,
You know, I should have had them ink her image in reverse.
There's an emergency, I said. It's my intern, Jujak. He's in trouble.
But I didn't know then, Ga said. I didn't know my destiny.
He turned to me, indicating his tattoo.
You see her as she is. I'm forced to see her backward. I should have had them ink her image in reverse. But back then, I thought it was for others to see, when really, the whole time, she was for me.
I need some information, I told him. It's really important.
Why are you so intent on writing my biography? Commander Ga asked me. The only people in the world who would want to read it are gone now.
I just need to know one thing. It's life and death, I said. We went to the military base on the road to Nampo, but there was no corral or fire pit or ox. I know you made a village there to make the Americans feel at home, but the actress wasn't there. Nothing was.
I told you, you'll never find her.
But where was the picnic table, the chuck wagon?
We moved those.
Where?
I can't tell you.
Why? Why not?
Because this mystery is the only reminder to the dear leader that what happened to him is real, that something happened that was out of his control.
What happened to him?
That would be a good question to ask him.
But this isn't about the dear leader. It's about a kid who made a mistake.
It's also the only thing keeping me alive.
I appealed to his reason. You're not going to live through any of this, I said. He nodded in acknowledgement.
None of us will, he said. Do you have a plan? Have you taken steps? You still have time. You can choose your terms.
In whatever time you have left, I said, you can save this kid. You can atone for whatever heinous thing you did to the actress. I pulled his phone from my pocket. The pictures that arrive on this phone, I asked him, are they meant for you?
What pictures?
I turned on the phone, let him see the blue glow of its charged battery.
I must have that, he told me.
Then help me, I said. I held the phone in front of his face, showing him the image of the star on the sidewalk. He took the phone from my hand.
The Americans refused the dear leader's hospitality, he said.
they wouldn't leave their plane, so we moved the Texas village to the airport.
"Thank you," I said, and just as I turned, the door flew open. It was Kyuki on the threshold, the rest of the pubyok behind her. There was gore on her smock.
"They moved to the airport," she declared. "That's where the actress disappeared."
"Makes sense he'd know what was going on at the airport," one of the pubyok said. "His dad is the Minister of Transportation."
"What about Jujak?" I demanded. "Where is he? What's happened to him?"
Kyuki didn't answer. She looked to Sarge, who nodded his approval. Stealing her eyes, Kyuki turned to face the pubyok assembled in the doorway. She assumed a taekwondo stance. The men backed up, gave her a moment to compose herself. Then together, they said,
"Junbi."
"Hana."
"Dul."
"Set," they counted. And when they shouted, "Shijak!"
Kyuki's hand struck the stainless steel door. There was a long, shuddering inhale, and then she drew several sharp breaths. Slowly, she pulled her broken hand to her chest and sheltered it there. Always the first break is a chopping strike to the outside of the palm. There will be plenty of time to break the knuckles, a couple at a time, later. Calmly, carefully, Sarge took her arm and extended it, placing her broken hand in his. With great care, he gripped her wrist with one hand, then pinched her last two fingers with the other.
"You're one of us now," he said. "You're an intern no more. You no longer have use for a name," he added, as he pulled hard on her fingers, snapping the cracked bones straight for a proper heal. Sarge nodded his head my way as a sign of respect.
"I was against having a woman in the division," he told me. "But you were right. She's the future."
It was afternoon, the sun bright and heatless through the windows. Commander Ga sat between the boy and the girl, the three of them watching Sun Moon restlessly wander the house, her hands lifting certain objects that she seemed to consider anew. The dog followed her, sniffing at everything she touched. A hand mirror, a parasol, the kettle in the kitchen. It was the day before the Americans were to arrive. The day before the escape, though the children didn't know that.
"What's wrong with her?"
the boy asked.
"What's she looking for?" "She acts like this before she starts a new movie,"
the girl said.
"Is there a new movie?"
"Something like that," Ga told them. Sun Moon came to him. In her hands was a hand-painted jangi board. The look on her face said, "How can I abandon this?" He told her that they could take nothing with them, that any keepsake might signal their plan.
"My father," she said. "It's all I have of him."
He shook his head. How could he explain to her that it was better this way, that yes, an object could hold a person, that you could talk to a photograph, that you could kiss a ring, that by breathing into a harmonica, you can give voice to someone far away. But photographs can be lost. In your sleep, a ring can be slipped from your finger by the thief in your barracks. Ga had seen an old man lose the will to live. You could see it go out of him when a prison guard made him hand over a locket. No, you had to keep the people you loved safer than that. They had to become as fixed to you as a tattoo, which no one could take away.
"Nothing but the clothes on my back?"
she asked him. Then a look of dawning crossed her face. She turned and moved quickly to her wardrobe. Here, she stared into the row of Jozon Otz, each folded over its own dowel. The setting sun was tinted and rich through the bedroom. In this golden, yolk-colored light, the dresses glowed with life.
"How will I choose?"
she asked him. She ran her fingers over them.
"I wore this one in the motherless fatherland," she said. "But I played a politician's wife. I can't leave here as that. I can't be her forever."
Sun Moon studied a simple chozonot, whose jogori was white and chima was patterned with pale blossoms.
"And here's a true daughter of the country. I can't arrive in America dressed as a peasant girl."
She leafed through all the dresses. Oppressors tumble. Tyrants asunder. Hold the banner high. All of your dresses have come from your movies? She nodded.
Technically, they're the property of wardrobe. But when I act in them, they become a part of me.
You have none of your own? He asked.
I don't need my own, she said. I've got these.
What about the dresses you wore before you were in the movies? She stared at him a moment.
Oh, I cannot decide,
she said, and closed her eyes.
I'll leave it for later.
No, he told her. This one. She removed the silver chosen ot he'd selected, held it to her figure.
Glory of glories, she said. You wish me to be the opera singer?
It is a story of love, he told her.
And tragedy.
And tragedy, he acknowledged. Wouldn't the dear leader love to see you dressed as an opera star? Wouldn't that be a nod to his other passion? Sun Moon wrinkled her nose at this idea.
He got me an opera singer to help me prepare for that role, but she was impossible.
What happened to her? Sun Moon shrugged.
She vanished.
Vanished where?
She went where people go, I guess. One day, she just wasn't there.
He touched the fabric. Then this is the dress to wear. They spent the remaining light harvesting the garden, preparing a feast to eat raw. The flowers they turned to tea, and the cucumbers they sliced, and let brine in vinegar and sugar water, with shredded red cabbage. The girls' prized melon they broke open on a rock, so that the meat inside tore along the seed lines. Sun Moon lit a candle, and at the table, they started their final dinner with beans, which they shelled and rolled in coarse salt. Then the boy had a treat. Four songbirds he'd snared and dressed and cured in the sun with red pepper seeds. The boy started to tell a story he'd heard over the loudspeaker about a laborer who thought he'd found a precious gem. Instead of sharing the discovery with the leader of his detachment, the laborer swallowed the gem in the hopes of keeping it for himself.
Everyone's heard that story,
his sister said.
It turned out to be a piece of glass.
Please, Sun Moon said. Let's have a happy story.
The girl said,
What about the one where the dove flew into the path of an imperialist bullet and saved the life of a...
Sun Moon raised a hand to stop her. It seemed the only stories the children knew of had come from the loudspeaker. When Commander Ga was young, sometimes all the orphans had to fill themselves with at the dinner table were stories. In an offhanded way, Commander Ga said, I'd tell the story about the little dog from Pyongyang who went into space. But I'm sure you've heard that one. With uncertainty on her face, the girl looked from her brother to her mother. Then she shrugged.
Yeah, sure,
she said.
Who hasn't heard that one?
The boy also feigned knowledge of the story.
Yeah, that's an old one,
he added. Let me see if I remember how it goes, Commander Ga said. The best scientists got together and built a gigantic rocket. On its fuselage, they painted the blue star and red circle of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Then they filled it full of volatile fuel and rolled it out to the launch pad. The rocket was designed to go up. If it worked, they would try to make the next rocket capable of coming back down. Even though the scientist that piloted it would be declared a martyr, no one was brave enough to climb inside. Ga stopped his story there. He sipped his tea and looked at the children, who could not tell what this story was designed to glorify. Hesitantly, the girl said,
That's when they decided to send the dog.
Ga smiled. That's right, he said. I knew you'd know the story. Now where was it they found the dog again? Once more there was silence.
At the zoo?
The boy finally said. Of course, Ga said. How could I forget? And what did that dog look like?
He was gray,
the girl said.
And brown,
the boy said.
With white paws,
the girl said.
He had a long, slim tail. They chose him because he was skinny and could fit in the rocket. Old tomatoes,
the boy said.
That's all the mean zookeeper fed him.
Sun Moon smiled to see her children engage in the tale. At night, the dog would consider the moon, was her contribution.
The moon was his only friend,
the girl said.
The dog would call and call,
the boy added.
But he never heard back.
Yes, it is an old story, but a good one, Commander Goss said, smiling. Now the dog agreed to ride the rocket into space.
To be closer to his friend the moon,
the girl said. Yes, to be closer to his friend the moon, Goss said. But did they tell the dog he would never be coming back? A look of betrayal crossed the boy's face.
They didn't tell him anything,
he said. Gah nodded at the wrongness of this injustice. The scientists, as I recall, allowed the dog to bring one thing with him.
It was a stick,
the boy said.
No,
the girl said.
It was his bowl.
And suddenly the two of them were racing to discover the item the dog chose to take into space. But Gah nodded in approval at all their proposals.
The dog brought along a squirrel,
the boy said.
So he wouldn't get lonely. He chose to bring a garden,
the girl countered.
So he wouldn't be hungry.
On and on they went. A ball, a rope, a parachute, a flute he could play with his paws. Gah halted them with a hand, letting a silence fall over the table. Secretly, he whispered, the dog brought along all those things, the weight of which changed the course of the rocket when it launched, sending it on a new trajectory. Gah gestured up in the air, and the children looked above them as if the answer would materialize on the ceiling.
To the moon,
the girl said. Gah and Sun Moon now listened as the children spun the rest of the story for themselves, how on the moon, the dog discovered another dog, the one who howled at the earth every night, how there was a boy on the moon and a girl, and how the dogs and the children began building their own rocket. And Gah watched how the candlelight played on their faces, how Sun Moon's eyes lowered with delight, how the children relished their mother's attention and how they kept trying to outdo one another for it, and how, as a family, they turned that melon to rind, saving the seeds in a small wooden bowl, smiling together, as the sweet pink juice ran down their fingers and wrists. The boy and the girl implored their mother to create a ballad for the dog who went to the moon. And since Sun Moon wouldn't play her kayagum in house clothes, she soon emerged in a jozanot, whose chima was cut from plum-colored satin. On the wooden floor, she placed the crown of the instrument on a pillow, while its base rested side-saddle on her folded legs. She bowed to the children, and they lowered their heads to her. At first, she plucked its strings high, creating notes that were fast and bright. She strummed the sounds of the rocket blast, her voice laced with humor and rhyme. As the dog left gravity for space, her playing became ethereal, the strings reverberating as if sounding together in a void. Candlelight was alive in the fall of Sun Moon's hair, and when she pursed her lips to play more difficult chords, Gah felt it in his chest, in the outchambers of his heart. He was stricken anew by her, overcome with the knowledge that in the morning he would have to relinquish her. In Prison 33, little by little, you relinquished everything, starting with your tomorrows and all that might be. Next went your past, and suddenly it was inconceivable that your head had ever touched a pillow, that you'd once used a spoon or a toilet, that your mouth had once known flavors, and your eyes had beheld colors beyond gray and brown, and the shade of black that blood took on. Before you relinquished yourself, Gah had felt it starting, like the numb of cold limbs. You let go of all the others, each person you'd once known. They became ideas, and then notions, and then impressions. And then they were as ghostly as projections against a prison infirmary. Sun Moon appeared to him now like this, not as a woman, vital and beautiful, making an instrument speak her sorrow, but as the flicker of someone once known, a photo of a person long gone. The story of the dog became more lonesome now and melancholy. He tried to control his breathing. There was nothing beyond the light of the candle, he told himself.